Well, the reason I wanted to talk to you all, obviously we have RailsConf Europe coming up shortly, and I thought it'd be good to give our readers and listeners a sense of what's going on, not just with Rails and Ruby, but with the conference, especially for people who can't make it this year or who might think about making it next year, either to the American version or the European version. Let me start out by saying, all right, what's new in the world of Rails this year? What's interesting?
Okay, I guess I'll take that initially. New in the world of Rails, I think the big thing is that there's not a lot new, which sounds kind of boring, but it kind of means that we're reaching a point that things have matured and stabilized. It used to be kind of a joke that Rails releases would keep coming out, keep breaking things, and you kept having to upgrade your apps. And because of the kind of rapid influx of developers in the early stages of Rails due to the superb marketing done by David Heinemeier Hansson, I think we had a larger audience for that phase of Rails' life cycle than you would normally have in a new technology. Normally a new open source project comes out and very few people use it. And it starts kind of gradually picking up steam with Rails. It was really just this big bang. Everyone's using 0.8 or 0.9 and living with the pain of upgrades. So Rails 2.0, which came out, I guess, almost a year ago now, it was late last year, has really stabilized things. And the stuff that's really going on in the Rails world is people figuring out how to do Rails right and not just do it like J2EE or do it like PHP. It really is its own style of doing stuff. And so it's really kind of a maturing and clamping down and figuring out how to do good Rails development as opposed to just trying to figure out how to do Rails development.
Rich, any other thoughts?
Yeah, I think another thing that's happened this year, and I think it will continue, is that the innovators were the main people that were actually using Rails. I'd say, up through last year, the main folks that were focusing on Rails were the innovators. People that needed to be, possibly because they were startups, and, they needed to move fast, things like that. But I think that those that have adopted Rails this year and that are continuing to go forward are what we'd consider more mainstream shops, possibly internal corporate customers, internal corporate systems, things like that, even government. We're out here in Northern Virginia, in the D.C. area, so we hear a lot about what's going on there. And there's a lot of movement in the government to use open source technologies, get away from proprietary technologies, but there's a lot of interest in using, and people are using, Ruby and Rails to do that. So I think it's starting to kind of mainstream, and I think some of the things that Chad is talking about as far as stabilization, learning that, I think that is part of this whole thing. This is what happens when a framework and language actually becomes used by a broader and more, we'll just call it traditional, development community.
One of the things that I remember hearing a lot about, especially from DHH last year at RailsConf in the U.S., was the idea of getting rid of Action Web Service and moving towards a RESTful infrastructure. I haven't heard as much about that this year. Is it one of those pieces that Rails programmers more or less take for granted in Rails 2.0, or is that still somewhat under development and adoption?
Yeah, it's actually permeated everything now. So take for granted is probably a good way to say it, although I think mostly that's still in the kind of leading edge space, but if you generate an application and generate the default scaffolding and all that stuff, it just does everything in this Rails REST style, which really is two things. The big design shift is that every application is thought of primarily in terms of CRUD operations on resources. So it's CRUD, and then REST, of course, maps to CRUD very cleanly. And basically, that is the state of the art in best practice Rails development. As much as I hate that term, best practice, that's what people are doing. And it's gotten to the point now where if you get on a project and it's not using those REST conventions, then people actually look at you funny. Like, well, what are you doing here? Is it on purpose, or do you just not know what you're doing? So it's not really even a decision that people make anymore, which is great because Rails is all about convention over configuration. And what this REST stuff did was just add even more conventions that take the boring, non-value-added decision-making out of the process as you're starting to build apps and get you thinking more about actually doing the functionality and what the interface would look like, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It also informs the way you model your domain. And I think that has, I know in the projects we've worked on, it's made people think through their domains so that they structure, the representation of the domain in kind of RESTful friendly ways. And so I think that's really neat. David, when he kind of announced it, that they were going with this RESTful thing, he talked about some of those changes to models that were necessary in order to be RESTful. But I think that now it just becomes the norm. I mean, it's just kind of the way to do it.
Sorry, what it actually ends up doing is pulling more nouns out of a domain than you would normally find, especially inexperienced software developers would normally find. And I found in my own work that it makes me do better object-oriented designs to have this kind of straitjacket of trying to make stuff fit the RESTful conventions. And sometimes it doesn't work, and that's okay. But what it did is it took a bunch of developers that would have otherwise potentially not thought really closely about how they were modeling their objects, and it made them kind of have to give a lot of thought to, well, what is the relationship between these two entities? What should it be called? Because normally you would just connect them with a join table, and in the REST world, it's not like that. It's, you pretty much have to, anything you want to manage via the web, you have to have a name for, and if it has behavior, then you put the behavior in the class that represents that thing. And like Rich said, it really does enhance, I think, the way that we're designing our applications.
The first question about that, within Rails itself, we take REST for granted. What about Rails applications in a larger ecosystem? They expose, of course, the four RESTful verbs and all of these nouns via URIs. Are you seeing people take advantage of that through other applications that may speak REST to a Rails application?
Yeah, actually, we've done several interesting integrations with, we'll call it like compositing, different technologies into a single unified application. One of them was kind of a layered Rails service where we had kind of a user-facing Rails application, and then another Rails application actually sat on a database. So the actual front-facing Rails application sat on a different database. And, of course, between the two, they used Rails.
Mm-hmm.
So that was actually just Rails using Rails, but it made it very simple to actually connect them together.
Right.
So that, that following that convention. We had another one where, and this is a different use case, but we had a Rails application. We had a very big existing Java application on top of a complex database schema.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to be able to have parts of the application actually be served out in Rails. And they wanted to visually merge them on the same page.
I see.
So we actually chose something called Edge-Side Include, which lets you put XML tags in and have a server that basically pulls down, say, like the Java page that, is rendered with rendered JSPs and pull out these XML tags, which would then go fetch from the Rails application HTML to fill in that. And would cache it and do all that neat stuff. But it needed Rails to work seamlessly with Java. Now there, Chad did some interesting work in actually integrating, sessions in the database and things like that. So Java, using JRuby, by the way, was writing the session data into the Rails session model, and so that Rails could easily deal with that, so that you had unified session management for across Java and Ruby. These were two different applications, though. Their whole goal was to break out pieces of the Java app, build this constellation of Rails app, and eventually just get away from Java. But visually, it was fully integrated. It was a very interesting, kind of integration effort. And we've had other customers that wanted to just say, okay, we want to expose this REST API publicly.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we want to design maybe a subset of our models, make them available to the public, through a REST API and kind of help them in designing those things. For that point of integration.
Right.
you know, I've worked with a lot of kind of XML interfaces to services that, you know, just kind of, they kind of wing it. You know, they say, here's what you send, these HTTP requests, and here's the data you get back.
Right.
So the nice thing is Rails is so regular in the way it sends back. It's very easy to parse in whatever language you want to parse it in. And, you know, so I think it really helps people. But I think that more and more folks are trying to focus on, you know, I'm a piece, you know, of an ecosystem here, and how can I make my piece talk to these other systems the easiest way possible? And REST seems to be gaining a lot of momentum there in general, which I'm very happy with.
Yeah, probably a lot of it is driven by the push from Rails, just, you know, being as visible as it was. But you are seeing a lot more of that, both on the open internet and now internally in organizations. So stuff like Fire Eagle, interestingly, does almost nothing. I don't mean that in a negative way,
mm-hmm.
but it's just this tiny service. And it's interesting that, you know, here they've come out with this thing, and of course it harkens back to the way Unix systems have always been designed, where you have little applications that do one thing well. And so we're seeing, I think, more of that on the internet. But then the actual reason that these REST services were originally created by the Rails team was partially for providing internet access, actually specifically with the CRM application that 37 Signals does. But a lot of it was David was looking at their own applications, and particularly Basecamp, and it was a lot like most big Rails applications at the time. It was just this nasty behemoth with, you know, huge controllers with long, you know, actions stretched out across multiple pages,
mm-hmm.
And basically just bad code. And a lot of that is that there was no convention to figure out, you know, to kind of force you to put stuff in the right place. But I think a big part of it was we didn't really have an idea of not just where, when you put stuff into a new controller or a new action, what you call it, but when should you make a whole new application? And, you know, this whole SOA thing that's happened over the past several years and web services and all this complexity came up in order to help solve this problem that monoliths are not good and it's better to have, you know, kind of small services that do the things they do well. And I think more and more people are using the REST stuff in Rails to intentionally, not from an integration perspective, but to intentionally composite one application, one end-user experience from many small applications that do their jobs well. And that's something I've done myself and also seen people talking about at conferences and people in training. And it's obviously a trend in the Rails world to take advantage of this stuff to architect single systems well.
There's a trend I've seen in the web world. And it's this dreaded word called scalability. And no, I'm not going to ask about Twitter. I don't care about Twitter. The interesting question about scalability is shared nothing versus shared everything. And when I look at pieces of a Rails application, I see that a lot of the sharing problem goes back to a single monolithic database. And the trend I've been seeing is to break that out, whether Memcached or CouchDB or the Amazon services. And I wonder if some of the criticisms of these so-called MVC frameworks, that the model is just a thin veneer over tables, is that a problem? Is that going away some? Are we moving away from the active record type model toward I don't care where my data is as long as I can speak REST to get it and update it?
I think that it depends on what systems you're building and for whom. You know, you go inside of a corporation, and we have a lot of them in the world, and, you know, their systems don't have to scale to millions of concurrent users and blah, blah, blah. They really have the relational database thing going, and they want to sit on top of, you know, relational databases as a storage technology. And so I think the active record model is going to be used, you know, for a long time to come. When it comes to other types of applications that do need, large scaling, large architectural scaling, things like that, I definitely think people should look beyond the Active Record or relational databases, really, mm-hmm. and start thinking about other kinds of approaches towards storing data and or performing computation in distributed fashion. And, dealing with things like concurrency, which is, way beyond threading. Massive concurrency.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things require different ways of thinking about your problem. And I think that, there's an opportunity with things like Bigtable and, other types of, table in the cloud type storage systems that, we can get away from, traditional relational databases and move to massively scalable distributed systems. But I think there are different classes of problems need different kinds of storage. That example of the app that I was talking about where we had a front-facing Rails application using a back-end data or Rails application, that back-end one sat on the database. The front-end one didn't. And we moved information to the front system, actually through the file system. So in that model, this is kind of an interesting architecture thing, they needed a Rails app on the front end that would render a catalog very quickly. And they had so many items that the catalog was only updated about once every 5 minutes. And so you could say that we were caching, but we were caching through the file system by generating source code, driving it into the file system, rsyncing it out to a bunch of Rails apps that would, read these things in. And it was Active Record, but it was in something called base without table. So it was not based on a table per se, but they were model objects, and they were in memory. And it would just pull these things in from the file system and just eval them up. So they'd come into memory, refresh the system, and it was incredibly fast, and didn't touch the database at all to do that. So all these Rails instances could sit there, and you could scale that literally horizontally out. Now, where we did touch the database, we came back, and that was a database-backed system. But for a lot of the rendering stuff, you don't need to touch it, and you get things like caching. But I think there's other approaches you can use, other kinds of data models, things like Maglev, which is an up-and-coming, kind of Ruby implementation on top of this massively distributed object store. It's going to be a very different way of actually storing, persisting, and getting objects, because there you're dealing with object graphs. You don't need to ORM them.
That was actually the impetus for my question. I was about to ask if ORM is dead or if it should be.
I don't think it's dead, because I think there's a lot of relational databases out there, and I think there's a lot of information in them, and I think it will be in them. But I think that it's different problems, different classes of problems require kind of different kinds of technologies.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I don't know if you've worked in big corporations where everyone uses a spreadsheet as a database and they just email it to each other.
I've used a spreadsheet as an application and they emailed it to each other.
Yeah, there you go. So most of the time when that happens, you feel sick and you're like, hey, this is not what Excel is made for. Excel is a really good tool. It has its warts, of course, but when you're using it for what Excel's made for, which is doing declarative computations across tables of data, it's really cool. It's not a relational database, though, right? And so the problem, I think, is that everyone, just because of where we are in history right now, assumes that a relational database is the answer, when really a relational database is a bunch of tables, which is not relational, right, and by nature, it just so happens that we use it that way, with relationships. And when you have an application that actually has that kind of a profile where it's a benefit to you to be able to relate data across multiple tables in that way and to do calculations inside the data source, relational databases are great, and ORM is a wonderful thing to be able to map the way we think in objects to something that doesn't naturally map there, right? But the thing is, a lot of the apps that we make, especially in the profile of apps that you do in Rails, that mapping layer, that necessity to go from thinking about data one way to, the object way to the table way is a completely wasted step, because you're really just dealing with object graphs. So I'm thrilled personally about the prospect of something like Maglev really working out, the gemstone stuff, because I don't want to think about SQL, and it's not because I hate SQL. It's because I hate SQL for the sorts of problems that I tend to use it for. So I think I'm agreeing with Rich there, but I do think SQL and relational databases and therefore ORM are way overused in the industry right now, and it's really exciting to see not just Maglev, but, you know, Bigtable and SimpleDB and all these things coming up and gaining some mind share and making it at least reasonable to now talk about this, as opposed to people looking at you like you're crazy if you suggest anything other than a relational database.
That's what I found a little bit ironic about what Rich said, and I think maybe a misunderstanding here. But it almost sounded like, Rich, you were saying there are these legacy projects where we need to hook Rails up to it, and in that case, using Active Record, using ORM is the way to go there. Whereas the story I've tended to hear from, I guess, Rails best practices, and I know you hate that term, is that Rails is great for new projects where you don't have these legacy concerns.
No, you can actually do both with them. I mean, it's very easy to map in even the worst schemas in the world to Rails.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not hard to do. It can be hard to do, but it's not typically that terrible. Greenfield is great too, obviously, you know, with a relational database. What I'm saying is, to me, it's not as much a technology decision these days as it is just a, here's what we do, right? I mean, you go to a company, and they're going to say, yeah, we store all our stuff in these big Oracle databases, and you don't really have a choice. That's what you do. They don't want to put things in an object database. They want them in a relational database. That's their policy. You aren't going to change that. And, you know, but Rails will say, okay, we'll store all the stuff in this big Oracle store, that's fine, or MySQL or Postgres or whatever else. And so what I'm saying is that there are classes of applications where you're going to need to store things in relational databases out of policy. It's not technology.
So are you saying that policy is the only reason to use a relational database?
No, I think that there are classes of applications where, you know, SQL and relational databases can be really good. I think there's some that aren't. I think then that if you want to make a technology decision, you make the technology decision based on what you're trying to do, not based on, but I'm just saying in most corporations, those are not really the reasons that drive the decisions people make, that's all.
Right.
I can understand that.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the conference a little bit. I mean, I think we have a pretty good sense of how you both see the world of Rails right now. When you were putting together the conference, were there themes that you deliberately tried to bring out, or were there themes that came up organically?
We tend to not really, actually I can't totally say this truthfully, but, you know, we tend to not really try and push themes as much as discover what they are. And so in the case of this conference, it's no different. I think with Europe, it is a bit different from the International Rails Conference that happens in the U.S. in that the European community is pretty different from the one in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
But the stuff that I was talking about with – there are actually sort of two directions. The largest theme is really about the kind of maturing Rails development process and, you know, best practices and that sort of thing. There's a lot less of, like, here's how you do TDD, because it's kind of assumed that everyone does that now,
mm-hmm.
which is a nice place to be. Of course, mm-hmm. they call it BDD, but whatever. And even REST, whenever you encounter some of these sorts of terms in the proposals that have come in, they're mostly about advanced usage of these sorts of technologies or whatever, and special cases and things you might come across. But we're finding a lot more of just, here's how you integrate with a bunch of different technologies or best practices for using JRuby. And JRuby is really big in Europe because Java is really big in Europe, and JRuby is the way to get that in or get Rails in to the corporations in Europe. So there's that kind of, you know, solidifying, here's how to do it right, not just how to do it anymore. And then the other thing is the track of what Rich was talking about with, like, learning and all that sort of stuff. There's definitely a lot of exploration there taking place. And one of the big trends over the past year in the Rails community, and I'm not sure if it's true in the rest of the web community in the same way, is distributed processing. So I know in Europe we'll have a talk, at least a talk on Starling, which is the system that Twitter created to do distributed job processing. But there are a number of projects that are active and seeing a lot of use now. Like, I can't actually even name all of them off the top of my head. There are so many for doing this kind of distributed processing work. So we're seeing a lot of that, and a lot of, like, Justin Gatland has a whole talk on how to composite applications out of small pieces, which is, again, sort of part of this theme.
Mm-hmm.
So those are, I guess, the two biggest trends that I see, compositing and distributing processing and data storage as sort of the leading edge, you know, what's coming kind of look. And then most of it is just tightening up the way we're doing Rails apps.
Sorry, I was muting myself. That was great. Matt Wood's talking about the Human Genome Project and the work that they've been doing. He actually talked at RailsConf Europe last year, too.
Yeah, he had a lightning talk.
Yeah, that's right. It was actually one of the most compelling things I've heard.
Yeah.
But his talk on genomes on Rails goes through the whole way in which they're using Rails and Ruby to streamline their pipeline of things that they need to do for genome sequencing. And it's really neat to see it actually used in something like this big distributed system, which is going toward this really great purpose. But, you know, it's not only a rapid prototyping thing, but it's actually using that, and it's using different languages. So we're going to be talking about all of that stuff. That was an awesome little talk. I guess it was a lightning talk that he did last year, and now he's got a full talk this year on it. So I think that's going to be a really interesting thing. So this is a person who's actually making real use of it in something that is transformative to us as people.
Yeah, I don't remember the numbers exactly because they were so big I couldn't grasp them. But when he was talking about, like, how much data he's pumping through Rails at what rates, it was insane. And he made a joke in his lightning talk saying, if anyone ever tells you that Rails can't scale, they need to talk to me, because it was just crazy how much data is pumping through this thing.
Mm-hmm. When you were listing, I guess, not really listing, but describing the types of talks, it sounded like they were trending towards moderate to experienced Rails developers. You have a lot for beginners, or does the community sort of tend toward this is for experienced programmers?
That has changed considerably every year of RailsConf. We started in 2006, and so this is the third year. And the first year, it was, you know, a lot of here's how to use Active Record kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This year, when developing, and I guess I lied, this is one way that we did influence the program. We specifically asked for advanced content, and we did it both on the International Rails Conference that we had in Portland in May, or June, I guess it was this year, first couple of days of June, and again in Europe. So we have maybe no beginner talks at all. I'm pretty sure that's the case. And that was partially powered by or driven by feedback from previous years, but a lot of it is just the community is growing up and the people who are showing up. There are so many resources available online that you can learn the basics of something, you know, on a weekend using your web browser.
Mm-hmm.
But also, when you go to a conference or really you go anywhere and you sit and listen to something, I find that if I'm a little bit lost because it's going too fast, I feel like, you know, challenged and excited, and I don't mind that it's going over my head. But if something's too slow, then it's just boring, you know. And it's never okay for something to be too slow. So we're trying to, in all of our conference material, opt for we're going to blow you away, if anything, and you're going to be struggling to keep up. Because then you can go back and, you know, read up on the things that you didn't understand or whatever. And the feedback from the International Rails Conf was overwhelmingly positive on that change, which was completely intentional on our part.
I'm just giving Rich a chance here.
No, I think Chad did a great job.
He agrees.
Well, let's talk about Ruby itself a little bit. I know the last couple of Rails-related conferences I've gotten to, there's always that, here's how you do metaprogramming in Ruby, and, you know, as much as Rails can or cannot be a separate entity on its own, there's still a lot of this is made possible by Ruby. What's the Ruby content look like here?
I have the worst memory in the world, but I have the schedule open, so I can look at it. Yeah, that's really where the tutorial-like content does come in.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people came into the community thinking they wanted to do Rails development, and some of them didn't really know that wasn't a programming language.
Right.
You know, that's sort of a problem we have. But, you know, a lot of people have said in the past Rails is the gateway drug to Ruby, which is definitely true. So the material that we have that is tutorial-oriented is really Ruby kind of stuff. Like Neil Ford is doing something on metaprogramming, which is always a hot topic. Probably mm-hmm. will be for a while, just because the Rails style itself comes from that. And we have other talks on, like, Tamo Frise is doing one on extending Ruby and different ways that you can extend Ruby. He's a longtime Rubyist, and I don't even know if he does Rails development, actually. So I think, you know, as people get really into Rails, they realize that this magical thing that wooed them from Java or whatever isn't Rails, it's Ruby, you know, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the advanced Ruby topics that really get people energized when it comes to learning new stuff in the Rails space.
Yeah, and I think, for example, Jonathan Dahl is actually doing a talk on EC2 and MapReduce, distributed processing and stuff like that with Ruby. And, you know, that kind of talk, although it's, you know, a lot of times those things are back-ended by, you know, Rails uses those kinds of services, those are all Ruby. And I think that, you know, a lot of the folks are doing, obviously, massive amounts. I mean, building a Rails application is building a Ruby application. It's just a certain structure of a Ruby application. And but I think that specifically in these areas of distributed processing, people are finding high interest in using and wrapping these services. So I think that, you know, there have been a lot of interesting, like, regional conferences in the U.S. and about Ruby, and, you know, we're going to have, you know, Ruby conferences and things like that that focus a lot on that. Now, those also have Rails content, but they kind of tilt towards, you know, a lot of Ruby-specific content, maybe outside of the specifics of Rails. And so I think that Ruby has a lot of interesting other domains that it can actually apply to, domains of complexity where you want to layer that complexity behind a really nice language, as Rails does for, you know, kind of, we talked about the kind of database-driven web world. It doesn't have to necessarily be database-driven anymore, but I mean, I'm just saying that world of the web, there's a lot of other interesting domains, like telephony, things like adhesion that map the telephony domain behind a really nice Ruby domain-specific language.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that Ruby has some tremendous potentials of moving out beyond just Rails into other domains. And I think there's a lot of interest in that, actually, by the way, from people that are using even Rails. You know, how can we actually layer, you know, some nice, rich Ruby API or Ruby language, if you will, a DSL, on top of our domain?
Mm-hmm.
Outside of Rails or anything else. So,
yeah, one of the kind of hit talks from the last RailsConf, which was a surprise, Ezra Zygmuntowicz did a talk on, it was going to be on scaling Rails, but it ended up being about a project he's working on for EngineYard, which is driving their cloud computing platform, and I'm sure EngineYard will be talking about it at RailsConf Europe as well. It's called Vertebra. And it's actually a very Rails-like and REST-y system for doing system-to-system communication in a P2P network. Actually, they're using eJabberD to drive it. and then they're writing Ruby DSLs on top of that. And that's one of those things where no one expected to hear about that, but that was one of the things that everyone kind of left RailsConf excited about.
Mm-hmm.
And it had nothing to do with Rails, but it was Railsy, you know. And that's sort of what Rich is saying without calling things Railsy. There's room for a whole lot more Railsy stuff to happen in different domains, and it will probably spring from the Rails community or the people who are kind of refugees from the Rails community because they're too cool for it anymore or whatever. But we're seeing a lot more of that, and that's really interesting. Adhesion is one of the coolest ones, in my opinion. Another one that's going on, not at RailsConf, but RubyConf, is RAD. Actually, I don't know that it's going to be at RubyConf now. I mentioned about RAD. We have a couple of proposals about RAD, which is Ruby Arduino Development.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Yeah, and again, it's a very Railsy DSL. Looks like Active Record, sort of, that Greg Borenstein did, which sits on top of the Arduino stuff. It actually generates code, I believe, under the covers, so that you can program the Arduino in pure Ruby. But it's totally informed by Rails, and there's just more and more of this kind of stuff happening in our community.
One of the big announcements, a lot of the buzz I heard from the International RailsConf this spring was about maglev, and I heard pros and cons about it. I'm wondering if you're thinking something like that will come along for the upcoming Rails conference, or we'll hear more about maglev, or is that yet another Rails implementation on yet another Ruby implementation that may or may not pan out, but we'll all have to see.
I'm sure we'll hear more about maglev. I know some of the Gemstone people are going to be at RailsConf Europe, and I know they've been making solid progress because I happen to know the people who are working on it. And so I have a lot of faith that it's going to get done and it's going to be impactful. We heard pros and cons out of RailsConf about maglev, but the pros and cons were really, I believe what they said, or I don't believe what they said.
Right, or I'll believe it when they show me.
Exactly. And so Rich and I have actually seen it, so we can say it does exist, and it works, and it's what they say it is.
Wow.
We haven't built full applications on top of it, so that will be one of the tests that it has to pass. How well it's usable on, especially its object store, because that's a different thing for real applications that we're trying to build. But, yeah, I believe that it's going to be big, and it's going to take away some of the pain that we have for both scaling, which is sort of the marketing thing, scaling and speed, but also just I don't want to worry about that dissonance between relational tables and objects. I just have objects, and that's what I need,
Right.
So I'm sure that we'll end up hearing more about that. I think they may be doing a Birds of the Feather session on maglev there where they can release more information at RailsConf Europe and take questions and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I'd also like to personally, kind of like make a plug beyond just maglev as an implementation for Ruby. And of course, ultimately being able to run frameworks like Rails on top of that implementation of Ruby. But then there's also implementations like JRuby, which is making good progress. There's Ruby 1.9, which is coming along. But JRuby does expose, a massive number of Java frameworks to Ruby programmers.
Mm-hmm.
And so for those that are working within a Java environment, this can be a very powerful way of building applications. And there are still a lot of people working in the Java environment out there.
Yes, there are.
So I think that I'm really heartened by that, the Iron Ruby work that Microsoft is doing to bring a similar type of dynamic language runtime to both the service infrastructure, on .NET, but also into the client with Silverlight. Actually being able to deliver Ruby and be able to run Ruby inside the browser to be able to manipulate the DOM in Ruby and to be able to actually, use a vector engine like Silverlight and a compositing engine on the front end in the browser. So, you know, to me, what's interesting about each one of these things is it's Ruby on a different runtime with different capability, maybe different focus.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things create a lot of potential. And of course, the work Apple's doing with Mac Ruby to seamlessly integrate Ruby with the Objective-C runtime, the Objective-C 2.0 runtime, unifying garbage collection. This is Ruby 1.9 now. Garbage collection on Objective-C's garbage collector.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that now you'll be able to build extremely performant, you know, full applications on OS X in Ruby. And it won't be something which is just bridged. It will be something that actually sits on the Objective-C runtime. So I think that, you know, that fully exposes the, you know, Cocoa API and, you know, that Apple has there and, you know, Mac is becoming a bigger and bigger marketplace. So each one of these platforms brings some unique opportunities for Ruby, for frameworks that exist on top of it, I think for Rails,
mm-hmm.
but for other things as well. And I think that all of those, including Maglev, you know, create a lot of good future potential.
And Ruminius, which we left out, which is another talk at RailsConf Europe. I think the talk is called Ruminius 1.0. I don't know if that means it's going to be done. I think they're probably releasing it at RubyConf later on, but Ruminius is the one, as a nerd, that I'm the most excited about. My nerd persona loves the fact that they're building this hacker-friendly Ruby implementation,
mm-hmm.
and I've played with adding stuff and fixing stuff in it myself as well.
Yeah, and I'll say the interesting thing about that as well is that because that implementation of Ruby is written substantially in Ruby, other runtimes that have built interpreters, for example, JRuby, may be able to actually use not only the they're all sharing the specification system,
right.
That Ruminius kind of started and grew out to this, you know, massive thing to say, what is Ruby? Well, Ruby is what the specs, you know, execute and say is.
Mm-hmm.
So Ruminius is using those. There's the desire of a Maglev group to actually use the same thing. JRuby is using that, of course, Ruby 1.9. So, you know, I think Ruminius is actually going to yield a really interesting runtime and, you know, grow to be something which is really mature, but it's also yielding a lot of code which can be reused to say we want to build this language in itself like the Smalltalk implementations were.
Right.
Substantially, but Ruby has not been because it was implemented in C.
Rich, what one or two things are you most looking forward to from this conference?
I am personally very focused or very interested in the talk on the genome technology, you know, what they're doing in the Human Genome Project with and how they're using Ruby and Rails to simplify the work they're doing, because I just think it's an awesome project.
Chad, how about you?
For me, it's the one that I just mentioned, which is the Ruminius 1.0 talk.
All right.
Partially because I'm sort of involved in that project, but even if I weren't, I feel like, and I've said this before, that Ruminius may end up being the de facto standard Ruby implementation that people use. So 1.0 release from a team that has a good track record of only committing things that they believe to be good, because that's really the only purpose of Ruminius is to do it well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not an integration play. So there isn't really a benefit to just making it work at some point, as there would be if you were trying to build something to integrate with some other technology. So for them to actually call something 1.0 is really exciting, and I think a precursor to larger adoption of this more hackable VM for Ruby, and hopefully the beginning of the end of the kind of common complaint that Ruby the language is great and Ruby the runtime is not great.
Mm-hmm.
It would be great if the de facto implementation that runs C stuff and all that were something that we could all be proud of. I think Ruminius has a chance of being that.